This is not a game, and you can't go around and abusing our children in this way.
A growing movement against critical race theory-based education and graphic sex ed.
You're going to take money away from actual practical education. What kind of sense does that make?
In this episode, I sit down with Gabrielle Clark, a Nevada mom who is suing her son's school. She says a sociology class forced her biracial son to identify himself with words like privileged or oppressor, and then gave him a failing grade after he refused to do so.
Now, we will do everything legally possible to stop this indoctrination nonsense in every single classroom, in every single school district in America.
This is American Thought Leaders, and I'm Yanya Keller. Gabs Clark, such a pleasure to have you on American Thought Leaders.
Thank you so much for having me, Jan.
So Gabs, I've been following your case for a number of months now. You actually have a court case in Nevada that has to do with your son being in school. In the court documents, there's an image of a sponge with a rainbow, and the words "reverse racism doesn't exist" are pictured there. And your son had something to say about that, and he got some pushback. Tell me a little bit about this.
That meme was what really kind of started this for him, for William. When that was brought up in his classroom, you know, he just politely said, anybody can be racist. That was his first time pushing back on, you know, anything like this. And when that happened, there was heated debate and discussion about it. And at which time, you know, the teacher decided to close the chat because they were in distance learning. First of all, saying something like that in a classroom is completely and utterly ridiculous. Racism is prejudice based on race, and anybody can be racist. So this whole idea of, you know, reverse racism doesn't exist, you know, well, in a lot of ways, I say, yeah, you know what, it's just plain old racist. You know, we don't need to keep on creating words and, you know, changing words and trying to deflect attention from the actual definition of words. It's all racism. I don't care who it's against. If you're basing your prejudice based on the race of a white person, that's racist. If you're basing a prejudice on the race of a black person, that's prejudice too. We don't need to keep with this parallel language messaging. That's what I call it. This parallel language messaging introduced into our K-12 schools, where the words don't mean what they used to mean anymore. You know, now racism is supposed to be power plus prejudice. No, racism has always meant prejudice based on race. And we don't need to keep changing the definitions. So William, you know, he utilizes all the words in his vernacular accurately, just like everybody else should. And he said, no, anybody can be racist. And that is true. And I am very proud of him for making that decision to speak out and not just accept some nonsense.
So in the lawsuit, essentially, your son was basically told that he has to identify himself as an oppressor. Is that right?
Yes. He had to list his identities and then attach signifiers to them. Oppressed, oppressor, privileged, that sort of thing. And they were derogatory. So for my son, as a white male, you know, and several of these other able-bodied, all of those things, then he had to attach oppressor or privileged to those identities. And there were no other options. You just had to attach those. And so all of his identities and how they intersect, he's just an oppressor. No, he wasn't going to do that. And he didn't. And that was before I ever even got involved. He just didn't finish. He just didn't complete that assignment. And he said, no, I'm not doing it. Because who wants to do that? Even if I had to fill out that assignment and I had to say, well, I'm this, 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 and this. I'm X, Y, and Z, so I'm oppressed. I'm not oppressed. I'm an American. I can do whatever I want to do. However I feel like I want to live my life, I can do that. And I can go as far as I want to in my life in America. That's why people come here. So he wasn't going to do that. And I stand behind him on that, and so do his brothers and his sister.
So in these kinds of situations, kids typically, because, you know, the teacher is an authority figure, if they have a different understanding, let's say from the home, which he clearly did, in this case, but if they might not be able to feel like they can respond.
William was born on Martin Luther King Day of the year of his birth. And his middle name is Martin because we decided we wanted to respect the legacy, right? And so my son is going to live up to that legacy. Dr. Martin Luther King told all of us not to judge someone by the color of their skin, but the content of their character. And so my son has been taught to do that his whole life. He was named after that idea and that concept, that legacy, and he's going to continue to do it until he dies.
Gabs, very, very powerful words. But this didn't actually start with your son. You had seen some other materials through this. I guess it's a kind of a silver lining from COVID with the distance learning that parents began to be able to see what some of their kids are learning. You actually first saw some of these this type of messaging with your daughter.
I was getting concerned about my children, like all of us were, because of the pandemic and distance learning. It was a very scary time, not knowing anything about what was going on with the pandemic. And, you know, over the summer, all of these terrible things, everyone in the world watching what happened to George Floyd, which was unbelievably horrific. And I don't care who you are, that was not acceptable. You know what I mean? Once school started again and I started listening to, you know, well, really overhearing what was going on in my daughter's classrooms, and overhearing some things that I wasn't super excited about. I didn't think that it was appropriate to promote things like Black Lives Matter. Black Lives Matter, they do. All Lives Matter, they do. But the organization itself, that was something that I did not think was appropriate to be teaching to my middle schooler. You know, all of this graffiti all over the country was being introduced to my middle schooler as art. Graffiti is a crime. Like, why are we trying to teach middle schoolers that this is an acceptable way to express yourself, to go and you know, spray up cars and, you know what I mean? All that whole business. That's not acceptable. You know, I don't like to introduce any kind of crime to my middle schooler. They're not ready to take in that information and look at it objectively. They're just children. All they see that it's cool to go spray paint, you know, somebody's car. No, that's not something that I'm ready to teach my middle schooler. I mean, that was the kind of thing I was seeing in her classroom. And so I started actively listening. And I can't even remember what it was that was said. But when I heard something that was 100% a no-go, and I told her to leave that class, and I found her a new school that very day. And I went to William and asked him if anything like that had been introduced in his course material. He said no, not really knowing that what was going on in her class and what was going on in his class were actually connected. But that's why this is so crazy. These kids don't even know that they're being indoctrinated. They think that the teachers and the administrators and their schools are to be trusted and that they're getting a proper education. And so whenever I asked to see what was in his class and some of the coursework, he left a blank and didn't complete. I knew, and I said to him, you know, there's a reason why you didn't feel comfortable, because this is wrong. This is wrong.
What are the kinds of things that you've seen that, you know, are wrong in your mind?
Well, I mean, first and foremost, the compelled speech aspect of this is unbelievably wrong. You know, school is compelled speech in a lot of ways. They tell you, you have to tell us what you know. Prove to us you know this. That's kind of where you expect for your child to perform. But when they're asking things like, you know, tell us your race, religion, your gender and sexual identities and your disabilities, you know, that is crossing an unbelievably visible line. There at no point has it ever been okay for most any government entity to ask those kinds of questions for any reason in school or for a job as a requirement for a position or a graduation. Those are the kinds of things that we are Americans and we have the right to say no to.
I mean, it's incredible. A lot of kids might just not be ready to take a stand like that when that's what the expectation is from the teacher.
Well, I can tell you this, that is why No Left Turn is empowering and educating their parents so their parents can go to their communities and eradicate this nonsense. You tell your children, no, I am not going to fill out this form telling you all of my business in my home that goes on in my home. Or no, I'm not going to fill out this form that has me labeling myself as oppressed or labeling myself as privileged. When William had to do that assignment, I had been in a wheelchair for several years and we were living in a motel and William was sleeping on a mat on the floor. His father died when he was 1 year old. He does not have a single memory. So no, he wasn't going to just say, I'm an oppressor. And I taught him that. We raised him that way.
So in your family, I presumably, you know, you've been discussing all these issues. And so how does that play out for you?
With my children or with my extended family?
Well, you know what? That's a great question. I was thinking about with your children, but do tell about your extended family as well, please.
You know, I'm in Houston now. This is my hometown. And I've spent the majority of my time here with my mom's sisters, one who is a Muslim and one who is a conservative Christian. And the consensus is all of this is nonsense all the way around, because you can disagree on ideas and you can disagree on lots of things. But the one thing that should be agreed upon is that everybody deserves respect and everybody deserves everything that's in the Constitution and every single right that is available to every single person in America, including my children. Our family dynamic is very unique, which I think is the exact reason why these types of ideas, critical race theory and other critical theories of this nature, do not work in our family. And therefore don't work in America. We are the exception that proves the rule. So my mother was Black and my father was white. My first husband was Black and my second husband was white. So some of my children are 3/4 Black and some of my children are 3/4 white. Now, when you just look at them, they look like Black people and white people. They don't look like they're brothers and sisters. They don't look like they belong in the same family. Unless, of course, you look at our features and then you can see that we do look a lot alike. But so when my son was presented with the idea only or people of color cannot be racist. Power plus privilege equals racism, you know, and him being white and his siblings being black, I mean, and his mother, you know, that was not going to work in our family. And when we discussed it as a family, his siblings agreed and they all stood behind him, as did I.
The issue that you seem to be getting at is basically that these kids are being told that they're inherently one way or another and kind of being forcibly categorized, and kids are being expected to accept those categories without question.
Yes, and that is just completely ridiculous. You can't just tell people, well, you're a racist because you're white, or you're a victim because you're black. That is just completely and totally asinine. You know, the poorest person in my family is white by far, okay? And I've got hundreds of people on both sides of my family. As black people, you can't tell an entire race that they're being victimized by another race in a country where we have been able to excel and succeed from the very lowest point in human, you know, as a human being can be, right? So my grandmother, her father was illiterate. She has a daughter who has a PhD in education. When we were going through all of those things, all of the history and everything, photo albums and whatnot, there was a signature card for my great-grandfather, Joshua. And because he was illiterate, where he signed was just scratches. There was no actual signature. And when my aunt saw that, my aunt with a PhD in education, she cried. She cried, and I didn't understand why. I didn't understand why. And I asked her, ain't Dr. Ham, because that's what I call her, ain't Dr. Ham, what are you crying for? And she says, you know, Grandpa Joshua was illiterate. And she just sobbed. In three generations, from illiterate to PhD, you can only do that in America. You can only do that in America.
You know, I'm getting pins and needles as you speak, actually. You know, my family are immigrants. I work with a lot of immigrants, basically people that came to this country with nothing and were able to make something, very much something of themselves. And so I think the scenario you're describing manifests many times over for all sorts of people. You know, I was looking at a Pew Research poll recently that was basically looking mostly in Western countries or Westernized countries, how tolerant are people of other races and groupings and so forth. And, you know, America and Canada, which is my home country, both were very much at the top. Again, curiosity in this the current scenario where we're being told that there's, you know, systemic racism and sexism and every other ism.
Don't get me wrong. There are definitely things that need to be fixed, you know, and there is definitely room for improvement. You can't overcorrect and take the attitude that the only way to move forward is to oppress this type of idea or to, you know, break away from everything that we've known and create something wholly different. You know, when my house needs something, you know, I get out some paint and paint the walls and, you know what I mean, to pull out some carpentry tools and fix it. You don't go set the house on fire. You know what I mean? And this is what we're looking at right now. All of these people want to burn it all down. You can't disassemble the master's house with the master's tools. That is nonsense. You can fix systems. You can fix things. You can utilize the tools that are already in place. That's one of the wonderful things about America. That's why everybody wants to come here. We have to turn people away all the time. My grandfather worked for immigration. I used to hear about it all the time. We don't have to completely destroy all of the systems and all of the wonderful things about this country in order to fix the things that are wrong with this country. But at some point, we're all going to have to look at what we're doing and say, you know, this is not right, and this isn't right either. You know, and I think that most people, most Americans are in that middle place, but we don't get a say because we've been represented by a whole bunch of knuckleheads on both sides, right? So that's the reason why we had this, you know, huge emergence of people, regular old people, just speaking out, flooding school boards and protesting and all of that stuff. Because at the end of the day, I don't care who you are, most regular, everyday, average people are just like, wait a minute, we don't want that. But we don't want that either. The politicians and all of our ruling class and celebrities and all of that stuff, they're just going to have to just get used to the fact that we have our own minds and we're going to do what we need to do.
So, you know, you're involved with No Left Turn in Education. So presumably you're interacting with a lot of the folks that you're describing here. Tell me a little bit about this organization. There's a number of these organizations that are springing up. You know, Parents Defending Education is another one. I've spoken with Azra Nomani not too long ago. Tell me about what your organization does.
No Left Turn in Education is fighting indoctrination in K through 12 education. All of us are just a bunch of parents, and we've seen this kind of change in our families. We've seen these changes in our children that we didn't recognize. And then when it started to get to a point where we were able to see exactly what was happening in our children's classrooms because of the distance learning, a lot of us, before there were ever any organizations to fight any of this, we were already looking at the video of all of these indoctrination ideas and whatnot and thinking to ourselves, what is going on? And once it started to get public, we all started to start speaking with each other and start comparing our notes. And that is how No Left Turn in Education was born. Our founder, Dr. Alana Fishbein, just had a bunch of people in the community come and start a movement in her living room, like she likes to say. and I saw her on Tucker Carlson after and having all of these problems and not knowing what to do with them. After, you know, asking for relief from our school and not getting it and not getting any real reasons as to why we shouldn't get it. You know, and not getting any real remedy for a real problem that they were ignoring and kind of treating like it wasn't a problem. I mean, you know, going up the chain of command to all of the people that you need to speak with or people you need to inform if you have a problem in the school system and getting nowhere, getting the runaround, getting sent back to the very first rung on this list. That was just devastating. When I saw Dr. Fishbein on Tucker Carlson, I was like, I need that lady. I need to talk to her, you know? And I reached out to her. She asked me, what do I want to do? And I said, I don't think we have any other choice. We need to take legal action. And that is exactly what No Left Turn in Education does. We try to educate and empower parents to eradicate this nonsense from their schools. And we do that through Facebook. We do that through our own website, noleftturn.us. I talk to parents all the time. And a lot of the times, the stories are just heartbreaking. Heartbreaking. One of our parents that I spoke with a few days ago, I think their daughter attempted suicide several times. You know, I mean, this is not a game. And you can't go around, treating our children this way. And abusing our children in this way. You know, pornography in our classroom, in our libraries, come on. At what point do you say to yourself, this is not for kids? I don't know what these people are thinking. And I don't know why they think that parents are just gonna sit by and watch that happen. But we have thousands of members now, and we will do everything legally possible to stop this indoctrination nonsense in every single classroom, in every single school district in America.
This changing of definitions is very interesting, you know, and as I've been learning from people a lot smarter than I am, this is kind of a central element of how these critical theories work. They change language with a lot of the people involved in society not fully realizing that the language has been changed. So tell me a little more about that. Like, what have you encountered where some of these definitions have been changed and people think they're talking about the same thing, but they're not necessarily?
You know, there's been so many times where a parent has been asked, well, what's happening? Or can you explain to us what you're talking about? There had just been no way to really kind of explain that in an all-inclusive way, you know what I mean? And explain what was happening under this umbrella of all of this weirdness that was going on. And you know, I had to read a bunch of stuff and watch a bunch of stuff from people who are way smarter than me. And, you know, the way that they explain it, it's great, but it's also very complicated. And it's not something that's easily understood. And so I started thinking about all of this and I'm like, I'm relatively smart. Let me see if I can, you know, kind of condense all of this. And I started looking into how to explain and how to break it down for parents so that they can then go and break it down for their school boards and their you know, their schools and to other parents. And what I came up with is that, you know, one of the fundamental problems is that this changing of definitions of words and kind of skewed theoretical viewpoints and all of those things that I've noticed kind of come under umbrella of linguistics and language. And so, you know, I said, this is some sort of parallel language that they're creating. And we need to start utilizing the language as it is supposed to be and as the definitions are supposed to be, and not adopt this parallel language messaging. And then parallel language messaging, that's what it is. It covers everything. It covers all of the redefining of words and all of the, you know, made up phrases that are really kind of nonsensical, you know, grammatically. When I discussed it with some of the other people in No Left Turn, we talked about it. And I think that is one of the things that we're going to start working on is how to explain to parents what parallel language messaging looks like and what it is, and so that they can go back and have the vocabulary to be able to explain and the language to be able to explain how or why this particular idea doesn't work, what it should be, and what it is trying to replace. And that's what we're doing. That's what I have started in No Left Turn, is trying to figure out how to relay this to the layperson.
What would be an example of a term? I mean, you mentioned, we talked about the term racism. What would be another example of a term that's misused like this?
I've had this discussion for several years. Didn't really have anything to explain it properly. But one of the phrases that I have an issue with is the phrase serial monogamy, right? Serial monogamy is an oxymoron, right? You know, that is ridiculous. That is not a thing, right? Serial monogamy is not a thing. And all of these scholars and all of that stuff get all hot, you know, because, you know, they're trying to explain to me. But you know what it is? It's parallel language messaging, because monogamy means mate for life. Right? One mate throughout your entire life. But this idea that one mate throughout your entire life, that is, you know, when you break it all down, that's white supremacy, Jan. You know, no. No, that's that, we're not doing that. You know, mate for life, that's mate for life. And that can span any culture, you know, any race, any religion. We don't need to try to redefine both of those words by combining them to create a new and completely and wholly different concept. You know, that is what I'm referring to as parallel language messaging. You know, there's no such thing as serial monogamy. You can have serial relationships, but there's no such thing as serial monogamy. That's the kind of stuff I'm talking about.
Fascinating. You know, one place where you can start, and I'm sure you're familiar with it, and this is sort of for the benefit of our audience too, is the New Discourses website, James Lindsay's website. Although, as you said, some of it may need to be broken down to be a little more colloquial. I agree.
You know, James and Helen, you know, they're geniuses. I am not, you know. And I think most parents, especially after having your brain sucked out of your head by having children to begin with, you know, you don't have the patience or the gray matter to interpret all of this and then vocalize it and have the language to explain and be able to, you know, intelligently speak about it. So, you know, I had to read a lot of that stuff and, you know, even speaking with Helen, you know, it's like I felt like I had to straighten up and, you know, I don't know, try to sound more smartified and whatnot. You know what I mean? Those are the kinds of interactions with people that you don't feel like you can really understand or absorb because, you know, they're very smart and they utilize all kinds of $5 words and things that most of us don't know. You know, and we have to look that up. I'm like, wait a minute, let me break that down. What does that mean? You know, and you know, I can't tell you how many times I had to go to a Latin translation something. You know what I mean? Because a lot of this stuff is Latin words and all of that. And I'm like, I finished with school. I don't want to do this. So, you know, we have to be able to make it palatable for, you know, the general public, for the egg, you know, for the goober heads like me. I need to understand things, you know, in a layperson's terms. Luckily for me, I have a team of people that I can, you know, bounce these ideas off of so that they can, you know, help me to see how to take, what direction to take this. But I've always had a problem with the way that language had been changed, but I didn't have the vocabulary to articulate it. And now we do.
So, you know, it's interesting what you're saying. One of the things that really strikes me about this, the critical social justice material and the redefinition of language and so forth, is that often these ideas, when they're faced with, I don't even want to call it like reality or common sense, something that, you know, most of us, you know, irrespective of intelligence or anything, can kind of agree on what we see in front of us, right? Very often these things, the fact that they don't make a ton of sense gets laid bare, right? And I sometimes think to myself, you know, in a way it's a lot better to not have to be able to think about all this stuff in all these kind of, the common sense is perfectly fine. Thank you very much.
Oh yeah. I mean, you don't need to hire some aeronautics engineer, you know, to fix a lamp. Okay. You don't need, you know what I mean? That's not necessary. When we send our children to college, they go to college and they have all of these theoretical discussions and they get excited about them. And they are, they're very exciting. And then, you know, they want to bring it to the masses, right? And then they take this theoretical discussion and try to apply it to everyday living. And, you know, the everyday regular people are going, you know, that doesn't make sense to me. Well, that's because it's a theoretical discussion in a classroom in a controlled setting with, you know what I mean, with open discussion. we don't need to be trying to teach that sort of thing to our 13-year-olds and our 15-year-olds. We don't, you know, lay fresh cadavers out on the table in science class and give them a scalpel and tell them to go to work. You know, we don't do that. You know what I mean? So why in the world would we take these complicated concepts and try to introduce them to these young children who are not ready for it? You know, this is the sort of thing that needs to be discussed and debated in the proper form, in the proper setting. Yes, that needs to happen. That place is not in my ninth grader's math class. We're making sure that those kinds of discussions stay out of K-12 because they're not appropriate and they're causing a problem.
You talked about how families are being impacted. Like, for example, families where there's, Black and a white mother and father, or father and mother. But more in general, I've been hearing this whole ideology is having an impact on families. And I'm curious, in general, if you've been hearing anything about this from the parents that you're speaking with.
Oh, yes. I mean, what's so crazy is that this is not, this kind of thing is not being opposed by the people that you would typically think are opposing it. This stuff is being opposed by parents that are Democrats, that are Republicans, Black, white, Latino, gay, straight. It doesn't matter. Everybody hates this nonsense. Because this is we're talking about, you know, regular everyday American parents do not want this in their schools for their children. And no, we are not co-parenting with the government. We are the parents. You are the educators. We want our children to be educated with a classical liberal education. That's reading, writing, science, math, history, right? Not social justice nonsense, not, you know, active citizenship, not global, you know, whatever. Okay, we want this. And if they choose to, they can ascend to the college level and learn some of these more complicated concepts, right? But I can tell you, all of this stuff that they're talking about and that they're spending all of this money on, you know, for social justice is taking away from actual practical education that is going to create the ability for all of these children to provide for themselves when they grow up. And one of the great equalizers in society is education and the ability to make money and to support yourself. So you're going to take money away from actual education and teaching, you know, literacy and all of those things, so you can teach about social justice, thereby making everybody not be able to take care of themselves when they grow up. What kind of sense does that make? Who decided that? Who thought that up? It wasn't parents. So we're rejecting that.
Tell me a little bit about this pornography in the classrooms. We've been hearing a bit about that over past weeks. There's been parents that have been going to school board meetings and basically, you know, reading from books and showing photos and so forth. What are you talking about exactly?
I mean, there are a couple of books. We have a list of books that we think are inappropriate for education. When you talk about stuff like the appropriateness or age-appropriate content, right? Yeah, of course, some things for high schoolers are going to be more appropriate for things for elementary school kids, okay? But there's nowhere in education where illustrations of blowjobs and whatnot, that's never appropriate for school. I don't care how mature your 12th grader is, that is not appropriate for a school. You need to be learning some reading and writing and some math, okay? So you can function in society. And then you can do all that extra later.
One of the things you told me offline is like one of your big, big concerns is that this material, whether it's of the, you know, racial or sexual nature, is actually very, very divisive for not just the students, but for society in general. Tell me about that.
I hear these stories all the time. Married couples who can no longer stay married because they're one of them is black and one of them is white. And in some crazy world where we've decided that if you're married to a white person, you know, or if you're married to a white man more specifically, then he's somehow oppressing you. What happened to love is love? We got to a place where we were accepting. This is one of my issues with the far right, is not being accepting of certain kinds of relationships. We had gotten to a place where we were saying love is love. Does that now not apply to the biracial people? Is there some insane thing happening in people's minds where they just feel like, you know, you can't do this anymore? You know, what happened to the lovings, right? The loving family. You know, what happened to that? I put up a picture of my parents holding me in the 70s on Twitter. And it has gotten thousands of likes and retweets and messages. I can't even keep up with them all. This is America. And you can have those kinds of relationships and you can have those kinds of friendships. And even if you don't understand each other all the way, that's what you do over time. And that's how minds change, not separating them. The minds change when there's a convergence of ideas. My family members, they get together and, you know, they discuss these ideas. And they're able to say, you know what, I never thought about it like that. So if we all have to separate now, we can't be together anymore. We can't blend our families anymore and mix our races anymore. We can't be with the same sex partner or whatever. I mean, if we can't do that anymore, then how do we understand each other and live in this harmony? You know, it was getting better. Why do we want it to go back to being bad? This is the kind of ideas that this new cultural shift is promoting, division. And I say no. All of us are saying no.
So Gabs, recently the Department of Justice, Merrick Garland, issued a memo to agencies basically to study potential threats from parents against school boards. What do you make of all this?
You know, there definitely are some school board members who are getting some very inappropriate things sent to them, threats and so forth. It's not just school board members who are in support of this stuff, but it's also school board members who are in opposition to all of this stuff. School board members on both sides of this debate have been getting some really, really, really threatening and scary pushback. However, when you go to a school board meeting and parents are angry and parents are speaking out and you don't like what they have to say and you don't like how they say it to you because your little feelings are getting hurt, that's too bad. I'm not a domestic terrorist. And just because I say what my First Amendment rights affords me in a school board meeting, that does not make me a domestic terrorist. And I really feel like, yes, absolutely, all threats of violence should be investigated by the local law enforcement, okay? Because we're not talking about organized crime or anything like that. We're not talking about something that the federal government should even be involved with. This is stuff that local law enforcement needs to be enforcing. And they need to be taking care of any threats, any and all threats to any school board member on either side of this debate. But labeling me as a domestic terrorist because you don't like what I have to say, that is 100% goes against the Constitution, which is how we got here in the first place. We're not going to be deterred, you know, by this latest attempt to discredit parents as radicals or as terrorists. We're not. We're parents. We do not co-parent with the government. And we're going to tell you how we feel about what you're teaching our children, especially if we don't like it.
Well, and this is actually a really interesting point. You talk about, you know, as a parent, you're not co-parenting with the government, but there's actually quite a bit of different viewpoints on this. I mean, there's quite a body of people, especially in education, who kind of think that parents are the ones who shouldn't have a say.
Well, they can get over themselves, you know, because I got the stretch marks and the cellulite to prove that these children are mine, and I get to say how they are raised, not you. You know, you get compensated for your efforts, poorly, I might add, but you do get it and you choose that profession. You know, I chose to be a parent. I take on all the responsibility of the children that I parent. And no, you do not get a say on how I parent that child. And you do not get a say on the moral and ethical raising of that child.
So what's next for you and for No Left Turn in Education?
Well, No Left Turn in Education works nonstop. I think I start getting messages at 3 a.m. and they don't stop until midnight because we work practically around the clock on trying to help parents with some of the problems that they've been facing in this environment. But for No Left Turn, we're focusing on making sure that every parent has the language and has the resources and has some place to go when they need help. And this is how No Left Turn started, and we're going to continue until we get indoctrination out of K-12 education.
Gabs Clark, such a pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you so much for having me on.
The defendants in Gabrielle Clark's lawsuit have filed a motion to dismiss. They say that her son was, quote, not compelled to express any belief. Gabrielle says her next stop is an education conference in Acworth, Georgia, on Saturday, October 23rd, titled Defending Freedom in American Education.